Well, welcome back to the Stanford Healthcare AI podcast. And we're so excited to be joined by Andy Slavitt, who needs no introduction, but currently is the co-founder and general partner at Town Hall Ventures. And formerly, you may have known him before as a senior advisor to the Biden administration, overseeing the pandemic response, and then ran CMS under Obama. So welcome, Andy.
Great to be here, Justin. Matt.
Good to see you.
We got to start in the same place we've started a number of other episodes with, like, what is the current state of the world on AI adoption? And things are still racing ahead. So the data we'll pull up, Matt, for you here is kind of the current LLM leaderboards. It's been no slowing down in kind of current models kind of overseeing others. But Matt, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, of course, as we always try to caveat this, as of this recording, we see this kind of very heterogeneous picture, I think, that's emerging. The closed labs are still in the lead on a lot of these leaderboards. And again, we could choose from a variety of the different benchmarks. But some of these generic ones, looking at text, this is LLM Arena, where they kind of pit the models against each other and sort of judge the broader output. I think that the takeaways, especially after the Gemini 3 Nano Banana launch, is that there's a significant kind of pulling away by the Google models in the image generation category. I think that's probably not a huge surprise, right? They sit on some pretty substantial assets, including, of course, YouTube. But I think on the text and then on the coding side, despite again the big leap I think the Gemini showed in both of those categories, there's still I think a developer preference for the Claude models, and that doesn't seem to be changing a ton, at least on the full enterprise side. And then as we look at text, I think everyone's starting to form, I don't want to say relationships, that's a little strong, but I think people are it's starting to feel as though the apps that they're comfortable with, whether it's ChatGPT, whether it's Claude, whether it's Gemini, I think they're starting to pick their models, and that seems to be the trend. So I don't necessarily see a big leap in the text side necessarily changing the game until maybe there's another larger breakthrough. What I also should flag is that, I mean, as a user, as you sort of talk to more folks in the industry, you know, the idea of memory is still a bit of a it's a bit of a nascent product shape, right? Like, how much of the prior conversations do you want incorporated into the current conversation? That's a subject of debate, right? But that does change depending on your use case, how much you enjoy or get value out of the model's usage, right? So, like, I can imagine a future state where it knows the things that I care about, maybe it knows my background, et cetera. And again, I get better outputs for the longer relationships I have with some of these apps, but then there's also places where that's not an advantage, right? Where you don't necessarily want it to pull in the fact that I'm a whatever physician or an AI researcher. I actually want to ask it a question to not include those things about. So it's still I still feel like that's also uneven, but it's still anyone's game. And I think that the one of the biggest takeaways for all of you in the audience who maybe don't follow this as obsessively as we do is that there's no slowing down. I think there was a couple points over the last, you know, again, remember this technology is essentially really only been in the public consciousness for, let's say, for 3 years, which it feels a lot longer than that, right? But I think that it's still early enough, and the acceleration is continuing. So I think any narratives that I maybe last summer that came up around hitting a wall or slowing down, I think that has at least for now not proven true. So.
And Andy, we were just chatting a little bit before we hit record. You know, you said you guys were using, you know, you saw Google on the top of the charts. You said you guys were big Gemini users. Where are you seeing your own usage, you know, today, where you're starting to use AI in your daily life or your work? Where else are you seeing it?
My sense is that our team for individually have their preferences, and I think it's probably been OpenAI from what I've been able to see, ChatGPT. But at work, we chose to use Gemini in large part because we're sorry for saying this, we're a Google shop, and you know, it just the integration into searching your emails and your Google Drive and everything else just was easier. So we're like torturing our team by making them use something that they don't prefer, and then I have a feeling they keep, two windows open on their two screens, one for their personal stuff and one for their work stuff. And but we'll change. I mean, I think we are very open to keeping up and adopting. We're about to bring in an AI research fellow full time on the team, whose job is going to be solely to keep us at the cutting edge. And so I have a feeling he'll come in and start, as soon as he's done laughing at where we are, he'll make some changes, or she'll make some changes.
Well, say more about that. Where did that come from? When did you decide? It's an interesting thing, for other, healthcare organizations listening or thinking about this as well. Like, when did you decide, hey, wait a second, we need to bring in someone to kind of get us into shape?
You go through this thing as an investor where the first thing you like is, oh my God, it's hard to invest in healthcare AI. It's hard to pick the winners. It's really hard to find the great companies. And then you go to, wait a minute, your next discovery is, shouldn't our current investments be using AI a lot more than they are? And then you go down that rabbit hole, and then eventually you get to, wait a minute, shouldn't we be using AI more if we're going to tell other people to use it more? And I, we went on the journey in exactly that order, and so we actually realized, wait a minute, we can't actually sound smart at something we read about. We actually have to get much, much, much better at it. And we have younger team that I think is very comfortable and very native, and then we've got us older folks who are excited about it. And our, by the way, it gives us a great opportunity to learn from our younger team, which is healthy on so many dimensions, that they get to be the teachers and we get to really learn from them. And we've just said, hey, get us on a course, set us an agenda, like what should we do? And they've helped us adopt a bunch of their tools like Granola and other things. And then this idea for this research fellow was actually one of my partners, David, said we should really go whole hog in this, and I think it will make us better investors. I think it will make us better working with our companies.
It's just this such an interesting journey right now, and Matt and I've both been asked many times, hey, come to a healthcare organization, give kind of a keynote on AI, and like, what should we do? What are a few takeaways? And one of the things that you mentioned that I like to push the leaders on is I kind of joke like AI can't be delegated. And what do I mean by that? It is moving too fast to say, oh, we'll make some AI bet, and I don't have to think about this as the leader of an organization. And then we'll pull up some charts here in a minute too, just to talk about the numbers and the change. But things are moving too fast. Where as a leader, if you're not, it's not that you need to spend every day or be as obsessed as Matt and I are about staying on the current top models. But if you're not continually checking in for what's going on, what's possible, you're going to miss kind of where you need to take your organization and what's going on. Because thinking about, oh, I tried ChatGPT 2 years ago, it hallucinated, it didn't do what I wanted it to do. So like, oh, AI is overhyped. It's like, well, models are a different place today. Capabilities are different. And there's some investment, and leader has to make that choice for how much to kind of stay on top of currently what's happening.
Yeah, one of the things I've heard you talk about, Justin, is just how much of this is really has to get into the culture, and how much of it actually seeps into the culture, whether you plan it or not. So you can sort of choose how you respond to that. And I think that's really good insight. I mean, I've always found that good technology can't be pushed on you, or it's not good technology. And I think that's what we've had in health care with, with electronic medical records and personal health records. Everything is like, let's change people's behavior, let's push them to adopt this new technology. Well, for the first time, in AI, and I think you've got charts that are showing this, people are saying, no, we're pulling this towards ourselves because we want to use it, because it's making our lives better, it's making our jobs better, and I dare you to keep up. And I think it's a very exciting place to be.
I think that's it. I mean, and I think if we dial back the timeline to, some of the earliest quote unquote AI healthcare, it was still kind of a software-ish thing. Like it was not something that the leadership felt like they needed to use in order to make a decision and sort of deploy it. To your point, very much the change management, very much a we need to get ROI out of this software. Now it but now I've almost it's definitely a bottoms up. Like you've seen it in your org. Clearly, healthcare is seeing this. I mean, Justin's got some data probably worth pulling up to show this. But it's almost as if like at home I'm using like email, and I go to work and I'm writing letters by hand. Like it almost has that feel, especially for those who are really using it a lot in their personal lives and on their phones. And so I think this work. This is from Graham Walker's off-call survey. So, it's probably not a massively representative sample, but it's a pretty good look at what we see too, I think, in our day-to-day. And physicians
Wow.
are
I'm just
using
gonna
this stuff,
wow. Look at
right? I
that.
mean, it's incredible to see that maybe even underreported to some extent, but if you're getting to the 70% number of physicians using this, but still that almost higher percentage is saying it's making them better at their jobs. That may even be despite that their institution or their organization hasn't really deployed something. So that's kind of begs the question, what are they using? And you can kind of see that data start the frustration level bubble up because they're seeing the opportunity. Maybe they're using it on their phones, most likely. And then, they don't have any voice from the leadership telling them, we've rolled this out or we've made this available or whatever those things are. And then the lack of influence, which I think this is probably goes beyond just for AI, right? I think clinicians chronically feel as though we are increasingly we have responsibility without authority. I think that's kind of been the name of the game in healthcare for some time. But I think that the communication, the sophistication level is clearly being outpaced by the personal usage and this sort of bottoms up phenomenon. And I think it gets more challenging as we think about all of the other things, security, compliance, privacy, all the other things that start to become a problem. I don't know how you guys look at these data, but like to me, this is about as much of a red alert if I'm a executive at a health system, that there needs to be a way to figure this out and to empower the clinicians to be able to use these technologies.
Well, I'll just call out maybe just a couple numbers for anyone listening. But one chart showing 67% daily AI use despite 81% organizational dissatisfaction. So there's this weird dichotomy of I'm using this all the time, yet I'm pretty frustrated with my organization and employer. And on the previous slides, we talked about most 71% have no influence over the tools that they use. 48% rate their employer communication about AI as poor, 0 or 2 out of 5. And so there's this weird disconnect, between that daily use and kind of what people are seeing and feeling at work. Sorry, Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is just screaming at you. This data just screams at you. It just basically says, this is a stallion, and you need to figure out how to ride it, not how to tame it. And I mean, for me, there's a lot of so what's on those slides, but the biggest one is, you can imagine 5 years ago saying to a physician, technology is actually going to make you do your job better. Physicians who suffer very few fools and who have suffered through many, many terrible technology implementations would have laughed in your face. And so it just emerged out of nowhere. And I think it's hard for all the rest of us to kind of change our frame from how do we protect people from technology to how do we let them run. And that's just a different mindset that I think you're pointing to that people have got to come to grips with.
There's the extreme case too. I think there was an opinion piece or a Substack that I came across, and I apologize to the author because I don't remember where this came. Maybe one of you remembers this, but the tagline was essentially, "We've made healthcare AI illegal in this country." Like that was the sort of base position. And yes, that's very extreme, and I'm not here to debate the nuances of it, but just to say that that is the feeling I think that some of this data tells us is that it's essentially being policed at an extreme level, almost to the point where the autonomy of the physician who can see and feel with their own eyes and ears and their own judgment knows that, yes, I'm a responsible adult. I'm a physician. I'm taking, but I know that this is going to help me in my job. The idea of it being illegal really starts to wonder, is there a policy lever here that starts to make some of this more, make this data kind of even out a bit more? Does it sort of unshackle some of the health systems who feel like maybe that's the barrier? I actually don't know yet whether that's going to have a big enough influence on, I mean, Andy, you're the expert on the policy side, but I'm just curious, like, what's your perspective on some of this? Because is there a way to, I don't know, to make this so that it's not quote unquote illegal?
I mean, when you've got a product that's good at open evidence, as people seem to like it, I'm not a physician, so I say this based on some of the data you've shown and my own experience. Good luck making that illegal, whether you're a regulator or an employer. I think it's too late, and I think it's a fool's journey to try. I have a lot of empathy for regulators. How do you regulate this? So I'm. The only thing worse than being an AI investor is being an AI regulator, I guess, because it's like, you are so far out of the picture, and the picture is evolving so fast that, to qualify to be able to render the judgments to regulate in this environment is really, really hard. And I think I have sympathy for the people that believe it needs some regulation in order. To prevent the worst from happening. But I have a lot of sympathy for the people who say, how? I mean, how can you do that? And why? And it's a fool's errand to try. Government doesn't do a great job of regulating things that are in steady state, let alone moving this quickly. So to some degree, I would caution a little bit of patience. Let the market bloom. There will be things over time that will be, perhaps worth regulating, and we can address those things at that time. I don't think it's a forever thing, but right now, I think this is much more about the human condition. And say, I think you, Justin, you're much more of an expert on this, and you are too bad. As there's a lot of things that make that perhaps are inhibitors around data privacy and how all of that works. And perhaps there's, if you want to talk about how to make people feel safer using AI and it not being illegal, perhaps there's ways to think about how to address some of those things that are barriers. But in general, I just caution against thinking that regulation is going to be a tool that it'll help do anything other than make people who render it just sort of sound irrelevant.
Well, say more as, obviously on the AI side, Matt and I spend all of our time, but you've worked with the past few administrations, and I know are in discussions with folks in the current administration on all things in healthcare policy, but AI definitely being one of them. What's kind of just your summary of kind of the current position for kind of where we're headed? Again, focus on the AI regulation now, but also just kind of the other pieces. Like, what is kind of the current state for where we're going?
The most telling thing, I think, and I wonder how many of the audiences are have saw the announcement of the last few weeks over the access model, which is something that I in earlier iterations have been working on with Dr. Oz for about a year. Oz came to me a year ago, just as he was starting the job, and said, if you were administrator, would you be massively encouraging the use of AI among Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries? And the answer is, if you have a healthcare system that is barely touching the people that most need the care, and you have an opportunity to really reach people and keep them healthier in newer ways, if the technology is ready, go for it. And I was jealous because when I was in at CMS, I was putting the brakes on meaningful use and saying, whoa, stop the craziness. But we were trying to get people to like actually, use their computers. And I was just like, wait a minute, this is not the way to do it. And now we're not, but we knew that if we get technology distributed, we would have a chance when really good technology came down the road. And this is it. I mean, this is it. This is the opportunity. And so what they did with this new model, is they basically said, we're going to, for the first time, we're not going to just pay physicians to take care of people. We're going to pay technologists and technology companies if they can demonstrate that the technology they're distributing is making a difference in keeping people healthier. And it's a really bold bet. So I point to the access model not because I think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. I point to it because it's a signal. And policymakers, the best thing they can do is send signals as to what their intent is. And if you want to read that signal is they are, and the FDA, by the way, has created a separate process. So the things can get approved without having to go through long safety and efficacy studies, which is really unusual for the FDA. This is the strongest signal you can possibly imagine to say that we want to push AI through healthcare and do it as rapidly as possible and reward those who make a difference. And I think it's a really bold move, and I think applaud the administration for it. And I think it's more important than looking just at the regulatory picture, which of course, we all saw that President Trump signed an executive order saying, he's going to oppose and try to countermand anything that happens at a state level on AI regulation, and that's their position. But it's one thing to prevent regulations; another thing to actively promote with the dollars and cents of the U.S. Treasury, as they are.
And this, Andy, I'm so glad you brought that up because we've talked about this many times on our show as well, which is like, and again, it often gets sort of forgotten in some of these conversations, is that not only is this technology cheaper, more performant, and more available to clinicians in the healthcare system, but it's also the same exact technology for patients. And to your point, like, and I think we have some data that just came out on this too, just kind of looking at how consumers, quote unquote, which we can call patients at this point, are using these tools. And the most sustained conversations, interactions are tagged as healthcare related. And that is, I think those are the green shoots of something really powerful here. Because if you've ever used the technology and put in your own data, we've talked about this before on our show, how we do it a lot. Even as board certified clinicians, I still find it to be incredibly helpful for taking care of my own health and to help me prepare for a specialist visit or whatever it is. And I think that that is shared by the vast majority of patients out there who are now showing up to their offices, hopefully more informed. Hopefully, maybe there's a couple, myth busting things that still need to go on in the office, but not to the extent that it used to be, where it was like, you show up with a Google search and you're like, okay, we're going to spend 20 minutes unwinding some of this. It's actually not been that same phenomenon. Now it's more, wow, you're showing up with, you've looked at your own health data, you've looked at maybe it's your blood sugar data with the model, you've had long conversations with it, and now you're coming to me with very pointed, specific questions. I think it's an unbelievable opportunity, honestly, to start to achieve some of those disparities that we often talk about in the show, the information asymmetry that is in itself a barrier outside of resources for patients to be able to maybe take their healthcare in their own hands. Anyway, I can't say enough good about it. I know that there's going to be some, as we've said, New York Times articles that are, edge cases, and we've seen some of this with mental health, and I don't want to minimize that. But on balance, I just feel like some of these capabilities in the hands of patients and thinking about how can I improve my health and have better relationships with my health systems, I just see the net positive here.
Well, it's net positive for the three of us, and the three of us have presumably access to great care anyway. Imagine that, Matt, you lived in rural, I don't know, Western Montana or North Carolina, and it was a 9-week waiting list to see a physician, and an even longer waiting list to get to see a specialist. And by the time you showed up at your definition. You weren't even sure what they knew or didn't know, and they certainly didn't know a lot about you because you were just grateful to get an appointment. In that particular case, it's not just cool, it's not just better, but it's a transformative experience with the healthcare system, and it's necessary. And one of the things that I think we're trying to push at Town Hall is let's create some purpose behind all this great technology. Let's create some purpose that really speaks to people. And our favorite entrepreneurs are those that want to solve a really thorny problem for a set of population that just doesn't have great access to care. And it's amazing, as you said, Matt. I mean, I in an afternoon, you can create your own personal health LLM with everything in it, every lab you've ever taken, everything you've got access to, just very, very simply in any one of these models, and query it any time of day, any time of night. And that is almost better than a text relationship with your physician, which is hard to come by.
Yeah, and I love that explanation, Andy, of like we all do it, and we can text each other as physicians. We can find the very expert, but despite that, we're still using these tools for ourselves. And I think it's those two forces, this consumer lens that we've talked about again and again, and just some of the numbers we've mentioned before. In a year, it went from 11% comfort with an AI doctor to 28% comfort. Again, this is a Bain survey, small sample. I don't think those numbers sound exactly right, but directionally, that's where we're going with consumers feeling empowered to use these tools to take care of their health, just like we do, by the way. And sometimes there's this weird disconnect of, oh, a patient is different. It's like, no, we're all patients. And yes, we've, as a group, know more about healthcare and how the system works than most, but we're still patients kind of seeking that same information, and we're doing it. And that lever combined with kind of the signaling you're mentioning, from the administration that this is the direction, it's just one of the most unique times in healthcare where we have multiple forces just pushing and racing forward. And on the other side, just because the lever we haven't mentioned too much yet is just the enterprise adoption. But there's a few pieces of data that just came out, and this was a Menlo Ventures report where they're showing, hey, on the enterprise side too, this is the fastest growing technology we've ever seen. People talk about, and I think we've seen criticism in the comments before, hey, Matt and Justin, you guys are too optimistic about AI. Fine, that's probably true, and people talk about AI bubbles and things like that, but there's real adoption happening at the enterprise side. I'll skip this build versus buy, but the other piece that is fascinating now is healthcare is one of the verticals, at least, that they call out as kind of being the fastest adopted, more than legal, other areas happening now. And so it's just this very unique moment for healthcare where, as I have a conversation with healthcare leaders, there's also a bit what feels like a skip the landline moment where healthcare has been the industry with negative productivity growth, versus others because of kind of how hard it has been to adopt technology. And maybe it's because the technology wasn't good enough yet, but now it just feels like there's this explosion of adoption.
It's incredible. And look, I'm old enough, and I don't know what you guys are, how old you were during the dot-com bubble, but the closer you got to things at the dot-com bubble, the more it felt unsustainable. I don't know that that's the case here. I think it feels, you guys are obviously much closer than I am, but I don't think it feels that way here. I think it feels like the closer you get to it, the more you see the substance and the potential. And so while there may be bubble elements to anything that's got this level of transformation potential to it, the hype comes along with it. I mean, how quickly has Open Evidence been doubling its valuation, right? That's going to happen. But at this, because there's only a small number of investors that can get a piece of that, right? But at the same time, when you get underneath it and you look at the potential for patients and physicians and what they're saying in some of the data you've shared with us today, it tells you that it's got a life of its own that's gonna, I think it's gonna run no matter what happens.
I think, and I have to agree with you. I think it's gonna be an interesting time for sure, because I think that the bubbly aspect, there's plenty of ink spilled on that conversation. Yes, it involves CapEx and infrastructure and all kinds of the bets that are being made. At the same time, when you push that into healthcare, the adoption, as Justin showed, massively increased. Now the question is, does the traditional SaaS incumbents, can they harness this technology, understanding their users fast enough to start to meet the needs of what is essentially now a bottoms up, as we've said, a consumer-based adoption rate? And I actually don't know. We've seen plenty of really powerful use cases, obviously coming out of the ambient space being the key one, the Epics of the world, the Cerners of the world, who are building out inside of their UI, inside of their incumbent space, some of these capabilities, recognizing those pain points. Is it a fast follow that they ultimately start to, meet the needs or not? I don't know yet, but it does seem like that is one of the biggest questions we all have, right? Is it build versus buy? Do I have to go source it somewhere else? Or can I, sort of count on my typical technology partner that I've already invested a lot with to deliver the needs and the use cases that I want and my clinicians want? I don't know. And again, this sort of still strangely leaves out the consumer slash patient side of things, I think, to some extent, although we're seeing some interesting applications through like the MyHealth announcements and things, MyChart. Anyway, it just seems very early to me. Despite all of the charts and the fantastic numbers, it still feels early.
Well, as somebody who looks at a lot of business plans, judging by these business plans, every application product use case is soon to be a quote unquote wedge into a quote unquote platform that's going to quote unquote transform a quote unquote organization. You see that every business plan has that kind of as its and then they're going to somehow build a quote unquote moat. So it's a really funny time to look at it from an investor lens, where you're looking for like what's the and occasionally you'll run across the true substantial capability, and you'll just hope to God that one of the three venture capital firms that's paying unlimited prices for these are not yet found them, and that you've got some advantage to them. But I think, that's where you got. I want to come one other thing you said, that which struck me, which is the risk of our friends at the New York Times, my friends at the New York Times, writing the edge case story about the bad situation. I want to see the stories as well about the people whose lives were saved,
Totally.
because their very rare cancer diagnosis was misdiagnosed by a physician, and I happen to know several cases like this, we all probably do, and AI just basically found them the one person like them that had a very similar set of symptoms and had a successful treatment. And I suspect that that's happening multiple times every day. And I think it's happening multiple times every day from the consumer patient perspective. And I suspect it's happening even more frequently when people are using the clinical tools like OpenEvidence and others, where all of a sudden, someone who walks into that physician's office who, hasn't seen, the latest research paper and isn't going to spend 15 minutes, as you've talked about, Matt, to research it, gets that answer. And I know it's more interesting to write the story about how Waymo, got stuck at a traffic light because a traffic cone got put there, but it's really important that the stories be told on the other side of this, I'd like to think.
Agreed. Yeah, and I know we're running out of time. Like maybe just one last quick topic, which maybe we can't drain here, but one of the things I wanted to point out, and this is the big unknown, the valuation of OpenEvidence, to your point, doubling in 6 months, I think it's, is it 12 billion, something in that range, is sort of on the back
Depends when
of,
this episode comes out.
yes, yeah, exactly. Depending on
Or
what, it's on the back of ads. Okay. And this is the biggest like standoff right now, which is when do you start to turn on that infinite money printing machine of ad revenue? And what does that do to your user base and their choice? And even again, we can't probably get into it here, but just to flag it, we know that these models are incredibly good at convincing people to do things, right? We've seen those experiments where they put the model in a Reddit chat, convince me, right? And then they have a debate and they don't know it's a model. If you remember that paper, that mildly unethical experiment, I think that was done. But the models won out quite often. And it starts to raise some other very maybe uncomfortable questions about we have to pay for this technology somehow.
yeah.
And we also have to be very careful how we're approaching the ad space and how we're messaging that ad to, again, a population who may start to rely on this as their health counselor, their advisor, right? And expect the unbiased non-ads version. I don't know. Like, again, I'm just raising it. I don't have a hot take yet on this, but.
I think it was really smart of them to make it free. And to make it the sort of a de facto standard, or at least for the moment, a de facto standard. But they did kick the can down the road on the model a little bit. And healthcare, it's a little trickier to do the kind of advertising that it is in other industries because of Stark laws, right? Because of anti-referral laws and kickback laws and so forth. So the natural advertisers for this, at least according to current regulations, and there's a place where regulations, may get begged, and we may see both court cases as well as opportunities to regulate differently to say, why shouldn't someone be able to advertise as a clinician on a site like that when that's just sort of not the world we live in today. Because you, so then you're left with what, like pharma devices, supplements, plenty of things, but it is for physicians maybe BMWs and things like that, that are golf memberships. Now you can edit all that stuff out. That's just talk. But I admire the fact that they didn't address that now. I think most people expect information in healthcare to be free, whether or not it just feels different. It feels different than other types of information. And I can't give you a real business explanation of why it should be free, but it feels like it should be free. And I think it was a good decision on their part. And so, what do you do with that is your question. And I think there probably are lots of smart people around there figuring out whether there's enterprise models and other models and so forth that are going to, carry some of the water. But I kind of, there's a pretty good track record. Think of Red Hat and think of other types of things where people have said, we don't have to charge for the thing. We can find ways to build around it. And I'm not worried about that, and so neither is a lot of smart money.
Well, Andy, thank you so much for coming on. This was amazing, and we'll see what happens next year. It is the most exciting time for healthcare right now, and really appreciate you coming on.
Well, you guys are really on the cusp of it all, and I'm so cool to be on this show, where you guys are, where I think, as you said, Justin, there's just so much interest and so much focus, and everybody dying to know what you guys are able to show people. So thank you for doing all of that.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Andy. Really appreciate having you on. You're the final guest of the year, so we're excited. We were maybe going to wear a Santa hat this time, but we didn't do it for the end of the year. Maybe a New Year's Eve celebration of some kind. But thanks for joining us.
Happy holidays.